Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Of late, the California Judges Association has pushed back against District Attorney Brooke Jenkins for the extent to which she's been calling out individual judges. The complaints made by the district attorney have been specifically calling out individual judges for individual decisions in a way that the California Judges Association, amongst others, has criticized. As far back as November, an op-ed appeared in the Chronicle entitled, "It's Wrong to Make Judges Scapegoats." It wasn't all that long ago that stepping outside of a courtroom and criticizing a judicial decision, much less the judge who issued it, was all but unthinkable amongst lawyers. This has eroded considerably in recent years. Some would say that this is merely transparency being applied to the hallowed hall whose activities are less than transparent. Others are concerned that the independence of the judiciary is under threat. Perhaps the judicial officers themselves have been placed under threat. The judicial officers themselves cannot answer these criticisms. They can't speak to these or any issues that might later cast doubt upon their impartiality or that might prejudice their ability to sit on a case later. Tonight's the first part of a series that looks at whether the independence of the judiciary in San Francisco, perhaps even the judges themselves, has been placed under threat. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, we look at whether calling out the judges has crossed boundaries. In a couple weeks, we'll be back with a follow-up program that looks at consorted actions designed to shut down individual courtrooms or individual judges. As always, we have a panel of outstanding experts here to help us sort things out. It would be hard to envision greater expertise than we have on tonight's guests. But our final most important guest is all of you, and there's much to discuss. Our phone number is 415-841-4135. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free. That's if you're outside the San Francisco Bay Area, call us at 866-798-8255. You can call and talk about this issue. You can talk about judges. You can talk about criminal law. You don't have to jump in exactly where we are in our conversation. And bear in mind that our guests are here to educate. They're not here to provide specific legal advice, but they will give you, they haven't seen all the facts, but they will give you some guidance to help in your decision-making and to help you really understand what we're talking about tonight. Joining us tonight, we have Judge Eugene M. Hyman, who served as a judge of the Superior Court of California, County of Santa Clara for 20 years, where he served in the criminal, family, juvenile, and probate divisions of the court from which he retired. He's lectured on issues of domestic violence. Besides the U.S., in Canada, in Germany, in Australia, and New Zealand, he's received a United Nations Public Service Award in 2008, retiring after many years of service as a police officer, lawyer, and eventually judge. Matt Gonzalez is the chief attorney of the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. He's served there for some two decades in the Office of the Public Defender and served a term on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. I should also mention that while my emails and calls both to the Office of the District Attorney and the California Judges Association have remained unanswered. Well, we're very pleased with our guests that are here tonight. And without further ado, Judge Hyman, Matt Gonzalez, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for inviting
Thank
me.
You.
So who would like to get us started? I mean, just what kind of criticisms are we talking about that created this bit of an uproar? I mean, this has been going on for a while. I've read op-eds that go back as far as November. What are these criticisms that we're actually seeing?
Well, I'll jump in. First of all, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think, by and large, we're seeing something that we haven't historically seen, which is a district attorney voice public outrage about individual decisions that she's unhappy about. And as a fundamental matter, I don't have a problem with judges being criticized. And I do think that the system ought to have the kind of transparency that allows the public to understand what judges do in a courtroom. What I find complicated about some of the criticism is when you look at the cases individually, they don't seem to me to be really the kinds of cases that deserve criticism. And so the criticism seems to be, in my opinion, about something else. For instance, the criticism recently for Judge Sandoval, who had reduced a case from a felony to a misdemeanor that involved the theft of some kind of toilet paper or something like that. It's hard for me to imagine that the district attorney would identify that case as one that needed this kind of public reproval of some sort. So it feels like it's something else. In Judge Sandoval's case, he's a former public defender. It's been many years since he worked in the office. He's also a former elected official. He served on the Board of Supervisors for a couple of terms. So it feels like it's almost more of an intimidation tactic in my mind. So it feels to just cross the line, because what you're not sharing with the public are some of the nuances of why a judge might make a decision to 17B, make a felony into a misdemeanor. We have a lot of cases in our felony courtrooms. You might have an individual that has prior convictions, which would maybe suggest to a judge that the case should be a felony. But the judge is engaging in balancing. He's trying to decide, do I really need this to be a felony? Can this be settled with up to a year in the county jail? That sort of thing. And when they make that decision, historically, district attorneys, I don't think would have picked this particular case for criticism.
Judge Hyman, we've had this discussion before about the independence of the judiciary and whether the criticism is appropriate. How do you feel about that?
Well, I agree with Mr. Gonzalez in the sense that I believe there needs to be more transparency. I think it would be helpful if judges would articulate specifically why they are doing what they're doing with respect to their sentencing. And unfortunately, many judges don't. They give a sentence, and as long as, depending upon what that sentence is, as long as it's a legal sentence, they don't have to give necessarily reasons. I mean, if a judge were to send someone to prison and deny probation, then they have to give reasons. If a judge were to aggravate a sentence, then they have to give reasons. If they mitigate, they have to give reasons. But in many cases, they don't have to give reasons, and they say that based upon the facts, the court's of the opinion that this is an appropriate sentence, and that's it. So I think we would all be better served if judges gave reasoning behind their sentences. I don't have a problem, and I don't think Mr. Gonzalez does either, with respect to anyone criticizing a judge's decision, whether it be in family court, criminal court, probate court, child welfare court, or any kind of court. And judges cannot respond to questions with respect to specific questions regarding specific cases. However, the California Judges Association has a committee that responds to criticism, where they're able to address factors that a particular judge or judges are not able to. So it isn't like if there isn't a way to respond. But if I can spend a couple more minutes, if you look at what's been going on sentencing over the past couple of years in terms of the legislature and the governor have changed periods of probation, the maximum period of probation now for most felonies is 2 years. It could be previously up to five. For most misdemeanors, unless it's stated in the statute, up to a maximum of 1 year. With respect to good time work time, when I first began, it was like a third off. Now it's 50% off.
But aren't these legislative changes that the judges are only following rather than judicial changes?
No, my point being is that, correct, they're following, but it's nuanced. They're being told by the sentencing changes that there's a different view with respect to sentencing. And I think in some cases, the message has been misdemeanors don't matter, and minor property crimes, whether felony or misdemeanor, don't matter. And I think that's why Prop 36 was passed, because of the perception by the public, rightly or wrongly, that property crime wasn't being treated seriously, whether it be by San Francisco County or any other of the 58 counties in California. So that's the message on the one hand that some of the judges are getting, is that, hey, we're sentencing too greatly, and the legislature is changing that. That is being taken to mean that you can fail to show up a number of times and not face consequences. And I think the public is upset about that.
Well, you know, I would just say this. I mean, I think one thing that we have to keep in mind is that when we look at jurisdictions throughout California, the tough-on-crime jurisdictions do not have lower crime rates. This has been discussed quite a bit. It's not that approach hasn't actually worked. When you look at the way the public understands the criminal justice system, they basically see two options. One is leniency, and the other one is punishment. And when you hear about a particularly egregious act of recidivism or crime, we all respond with this idea that that person should be punished. But punishment has to be understood not in the short term, but in the long term. Okay, you send somebody to prison for 4 years, they're going to get out, and then guess what? They have a bigger problem, because none of those problems got addressed while they were in prison. It's not as if they're going to college, or they're getting job training, or their issues of addiction are being addressed. So if we know punishment is only delaying society's requirement to deal with the situation, we have not leniency, but we have something called rehabilitation. And rehabilitation doesn't mean we don't care about public safety. It's actually we're trying to figure out, can we take this person who we're very upset with, who is engaged in antisocial behavior, and can we fashion something to fix it before we send them off to prison? And sometimes we're successful, and guess what? Sometimes we fail. And when we fail, we try to sort it out again. But I think it's just important when we think about judges making decisions to give somebody probation or a lower prison sentence, it doesn't mean they don't care about public safety. They're actually, you know, they're actually grappling with it and trying to sort out, can we balance public safety with getting somebody straight?
Well, there's another problem, and that is that, and I agree with you that we should be very concerned about rehabilitation programs. Please remember when Prop 47 was passed, and I supported 47 as well as 57 as well as the original 36. So I don't come from a place of just, you know, lock them up. But as a result of that, making drug offenses misdemeanors, the defense bar stop encouraging people to go to drug court. That's number one. Number two, if you do go to prison, we have, what, 26 prisons in California? Not all of them have substance abuse. Not all of them have literacy. Now, it's not the fault of the prisoners that we don't have these programs, but that's the other thing. Why don't wardens have to be responsible in terms of recidivism of their inmates? Now, I appreciate that some of the really, really bad dudes are, you know, going to recidivate. But, you know, people that have substance abuse problems, why doesn't every prison have a substance abuse program or in literacy programs? They don't, and they're not held accountable for that. And so instead, we could be changing things in the sense that if you pick up a under the influence or a minor drug personal use, you're put on formal probation rather than informal probation. You don't want to participate in drug treatment? We can't force you to, but we're going to continue to test you. And ultimately, you will be participating because you're going to get tired of being locked up for short periods of time along the way, that there must be consequences. There has to be reasonable consequences. I certainly don't want to be locking people up for their first or second petty theft. But at some point, when you continue to fail to appear, and some of this was set up by COVID because we didn't want to lock people up because it was a death sentence. I get that. But it isn't a death sentence now. There is ways of being vaccinated. Some people refuse to do it, and that's their choice. But there needs to be consequences. You can't continually stick your thumb at the system, fail to appear, and say, hey, it's a misdemeanor, it doesn't matter. Misdemeanors matter for numerous reasons. Misdemeanors are an opportunity to appropriately intervene, provide rehabilitation, and keep a person from committing more serious crimes. Again, I want to work with someone. I want to help someone. We need to have the programs available, and we need to insist that people participate. And if they don't, they face consequences.
Well, I'll just say, you know, if you look historically at where crime rates are today compared to when I started, 35 years ago, they are dramatically lower. And that's violent crime. That's property crime. It's unbelievable how dramatic the crime rate numbers have gone down. Folks arguing the other position will invariably argue, well, people aren't reporting crimes or this or that. But if that's the argument, you know, this would have been true 10, 20, 25 years ago. There's just been a dramatic decline in crime. The public doesn't feel that way because they're now seeing, with the advent of so many public cameras everywhere, they're seeing the crime happen. And news media loves to republish these images over and over again. And so people feel less safe. But there has been a dramatic change. To your point, Judge Hyman, about misdemeanors, I agree. Misdemeanors are a public offense and should be taken serious. But when you say that there's no consequence for failing to appear in a misdemeanor and things like that, I don't agree with you. I don't think that's the historically example that I've seen in court. People get punished for contempt. The consideration of keeping them in custody while they await trial is a real thing. I just don't have the experience that you're sharing.
Okay. Well, the difference between San Francisco and Santa Clara County, I guess.
Even at that, a wise judge who doesn't sit in either San Francisco or Santa Clara County once phrased it, we could keep on doing things the same way we have, but then we would be rather foolish to expect different results. And by doing things that are more treatment-oriented, the idea is not to be softer on the poor misunderstood person that is accused of a crime, but rather to create the state of events, to create that state of being where they're not doing stuff. And a better thing that we should be doing as we're looking at it as a society is to take a step back and say, what can we do to make sure that your house isn't going to get broken into? What's going to make us safe to where we're not robbed on the streets? And if that's punishment, if that's putting someone away, we go in that direction. If that's treating someone, we go in that direction. If it's finding that what's happened, what the person did just doesn't warrant that level of punishment, we shouldn't give it. And the wisdom is to know the difference and to know when to apply those different things. I'm looking at an article from last November. Well, there was a public protest outside the courthouse because an individual who had pled to a stabbing was given a chance to participate in mental health treatment instead of going to prison. And the district attorney herself attended that protest to get people pumped up to where the net result is that this judge, who was a visiting judge herself, started getting death threats. Isn't that somewhat excessive? I mean, isn't it required by the, or at least suggested by the American Bar Association model rules that one of the first duties of the prosecutor is to protect the judges, to protect the process?
Well, I think the judge needs to give his or her reasons for a sentence. If the DA is unhappy, they have the right of appeal. If the defense is unhappy, they have the right of appeal. And hopefully the appellate court reviews it, and they are more likely to give reasons for what needs to be done than the trial court is in many instances. I don't know, in the example that you cite, I don't know what the appropriate thing is to do, because I'm not aware of all the facts. I'm not offended by sending a person to some kind of mental health facility. But again, I don't know all the facts, so I'm not in the position to be able to say what should have been done. I am in a position to say that it's wrong, in my opinion, mention judges by specific name. I don't have a problem with any DA criticizing decisions, but I don't think they ought to be – they're allowed to. Obviously, they have a First Amendment right. I don't think it's helpful to criticize by name. And I think there needs to be more of an opportunity for the community to invite whether it be California judges or individual judges from the community, and to explain the process, because a lot of people don't understand the process. Having said that, you know, I can understand why, even if the crime rate is going down, where a person who's been violated, who's had their home burglarized, isn't going to be very concerned whether the crime rate is going down or not. They're going to be concerned about the person that broke into their house, urinated and defecated in their house, stole stuff from their house, and then when they get caught, they receive a relatively minor sentence because the person had a drug problem or only stealing to support their drug habit. A person in that situation, understandably, in my opinion, is going to want that person locked up for a significant period of time. And they're not going to be concerned in terms of what that person's going to look like when they come out. They only know that they've been violated in all senses of that word, and that they're going to want a pound of flesh. And at some aspect of it, I understand.
But let me address the example you're putting out, Judge Hyman. I think it's a mistake to think that somebody gets leniency because we don't care about what they did. We can be offended by what they did. We can believe it's wrong. We can incarcerate someone while we try to sort out what should happen. But what guides us is not a principle of we don't care what they did. What guides us is how do we make people safe? And if we can achieve safety, if we can get the perpetrator into a position where the likelihood of reoffending is nil, then the people that suffered that crime, I don't think are going to be upset in the same way that they would be if we were sentencing somebody because we don't care what they did. That's not really, you know, that's not what's driving the judicial decision. I would also say, let's keep this in mind. Whatever a judge does at sentencing has to follow legislative statutes. So a judge cannot send someone to mental health diversion if it is not allowed under state statute. And so you don't have this kind of like aberration by a judge just to do whatever they want with no guidance. No, they're following very strict rules. But oftentimes those rules allow them to exercise discretion and do something for somebody that they think could actually benefit everybody. The judge you're talking about was not a visiting judge. I believe it was Kay Sennin. She was a retired judge from San Francisco that was sitting as a retired judge, very experienced judge. We're not talking about somebody that has a reputation for leniency. So, you know, I think, as you indicated, I don't know the specifics of that particular case, but I would be very surprised to learn that the judge did, you know, imposed a sentence because she didn't care what the person was convicted of, you know. And I know you're not suggesting that, Judge Hyman, but I think a lot of people hear these sentences that they think aren't strict enough, and they conclude that the judge doesn't care what the perpetrator did, and that's just not the case.
One thing I find troubling in looking at the, in taking a step back and looking at the situation, is that judges themselves are prevented by judicial rules from commenting on pending cases, commenting publicly how I would deal with a case. They can't tell you their political views. They can't tell you publicly why they did something. They certainly can when they're ruling, when they're making a ruling from the bench. But when they leave the bench, they can't go outside and say, this is why this person gets it, or this is why I went differently, and this they are bound not to. And this leaves their decisions up into uninformed or misguided critiques from sometimes elected officials, sometimes community leaders, sometimes crime victim families who may not fully understand the facts of the case that have been developed or the person that they're dealing with.
Well, they certainly could give their reasons in terms of why they're imposing a particular sentence, and they don't always do that, which is a choice. The other thing that—
Let me interrupt you for one. When you say they can give their reasons, you mean when they're ruling on the record?
Correct.
But then when somebody else speaks of it outside—
No.
They can't clarify it or say anything.
No, but they don't always give reasons why they're imposing, you know, if it's a felony sentence, assuming that it's a prison sentence, you use triads. And if the person is using, if a judge is using the appropriate midterm, if that's the appropriate term, then it's presumptive. It's if you're giving the midterm, it's presumed to be appropriate. You have to go into extensive reasons pursuant to rules of court if you're giving a mitigated sentence or an aggravated sentence. But if you're giving a midterm, it's presumptive that it's appropriate. And I think it's more helpful if you're granting probation, helpful to the community to understand where a person's coming from, if you actually spend some time and develop a record in terms of why you're doing a particular course of conduct. And that doesn't always happen, which I think is unfortunate.
I agree with you. I think it's very important that we try to share why we're doing certain things with the public to the extent that we can or to whoever is interested. You know, it's often the case, I think the cases that really challenge the system are the recidivism cases, the repeat offenders, and or the offenders that maybe commit crime while they're out on bail or OR. And it really tests the patience of the system. But, you know, the system is wise insofar as, you know, judges with experience have to grapple with that kind of dichotomy that I set up. Is it rehabilitation or is it punishment? And I think they are very aware of this reality that I think lawyers that work in the system are aware of, that when you send somebody to prison, you're just delaying the fact that you're going to have to deal with their situation when they finish their prison sentence. And trying to address their problems before a prison sentence is also sometimes, while that individual is still connected to community, to family, they may have stable housing. There are a lot of things that they have that are going favorably that you're trying to harness into making a law-abiding life. Doesn't always work, but the motivation is very much one to increase safety. It's not one to disregard bad conduct.
Well, not too many people go to prison their first time out unless they've committed a very serious crime.
When we come back in the second half, I would like to talk to you a little bit about some of the options that people have. Some of the options if an individual judge is not following the law. Some of the options if a mistake's been made in an individual case. And I would also like to discuss the difference between appropriate and inappropriate criticism, the kind that lead to death threats versus the kind that might help a judge correct the way they're going about it and get a better sense of the community so that ultimately we want them to be part of the community and for the community values, maybe not their individual decisions substituting that for the judge, but maybe the community values being upheld by the judges. We'll pick that up in our second half. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we're here talking about the independence of judges, the independent judiciary. Is that under threat? In this first part, we're talking about comments that are made that call out individual judges and perhaps even place them in danger. In a future week, coming up in a couple weeks, we'll talk about some more structural changes and what's being done. But tonight we're talking about whether these critiques exceed boundaries, whether it makes it unsafe. And I'm here with some really top-notch experts. I have the chief attorney of the San Francisco Public Defender's Office, Matt Gonzalez. He should be known to all of us that have lived in the city for a long time. He's served a term on the Board of Supervisors. In addition, we have Judge Eugene Hyman, retired, who sat on the Santa Clara County Superior Court for some years, for some 20 years, served in a variety of capacities on the court, has served as a police officer, knows this area quite well. Our most important guest is you. You should feel free to join us. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. If you want to call with your thoughts about criminal justice, you have questions about criminal law or criminal defense, whatever it may be, feel free to call us and join us. You don't have to join in the exact moment we are in our conversation. And what we're talking about here today is not unique to San Francisco. I did receive a comment from a listener who commented about what's happening on the national level, where the executive branch, up through and including our president, is questioning the decisions of the court and perhaps undermining judicial decisions that it agrees with, and even has talked about maybe it's time to start impeaching judges and getting rid of them. If the judiciary lacks the power to, for example, enforce contempt citations issued against the executive branch, and it can simply ignore judicial orders, do you foresee a potential breakdown of the criminal justice system if judges can no longer have their orders enforced?
Well, I mean, I'm not overly concerned about it. Maybe I should be. I think that we're a long way away from having this being done nationally. I'm very concerned what happened to a judge in Santa Clara County, however, who gave a sentencing that he thought was appropriate, gave reasons for it. He followed probation's recommendation, and he was recalled. And I think that sends a very chilling message to judges in terms of how they proceed. And he was endorsed by every living district attorney in Santa Clara County, and that didn't save him.
The other thing you're leaving out, people were furious because he gave what the public was taught to believe is a very short sentence, and an inappropriately short sentence, when in reality it was more than double what was recommended in the probation report. And the victim of that crime herself in that probation report, which I read, stated to probation, jail's not the answer. I don't want him to do jail. I want him to get some kind of treatment. She was apparently approached before sentencing, and at sentencing came in somewhere different, and the judge responded by doubling the time that the probation officer had called for.
Well, he received 6 months with good time, work time, did 3 months, and a Stanford professor led the recall effort and convinced the public, and the San Jose Mercury endorsed the recall. So, look, these kinds of things happen. It's unfortunate. First time in 83 years. It's inappropriate, in my view. It happened, and we need to be vigilant, but that doesn't mean that I stayed up after that happened. I stayed up nights worrying about it. I'm worried more about that if we don't get it together, there will be propositions placed on the ballot which will change the ability for judges to have discretion, just like the most recent Prop 36. So either people start responding to having a dialogue with the community so the community understands why things happen, or there will be more propositions and they'll be taking away judicial discretion, which certainly the judges don't want.
I understand, and I don't want to harp on this. My concern, I think you gave, you didn't really see the import of what was called in about the federal decision. And let me point a parallel to what's happening here. How can we expect common criminals to be held account if others openly flaunt the law, flaunt the rules, and do what suits them? Justice Brandeis, as far back as 1928, commented that if the government itself becomes a lawbreaker, and that includes the government as members, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy. To declare that the administration of the criminal law, the ends justifies the means. To declare that the government may commit crimes in order to secure the conviction of a private criminal, this would bring terrible retribution. With that in mind, I'm looking back at the comment that was called in about what's happening at the national level with executive branch officials. I wasn't looking to call out specific individual names. I did hear from Elon Musk talk about it's time to start removing judges and talking about anybody in Congress
That comes up all the time.
Not to that level. To this level.
There was someone way back when, Newt Gingrich, who was unhappy about a federal judge's district court. He excluded evidence, and he was on a talk show, and he says that federal judge needs to be recalled, impeached. This kind of stuff happens all the time. Now, does that mean that we don't take it seriously? Of course we do. I'm more concerned about death threats. In San Francisco, to judges who are called out for their decisions. I'm more concerned about that. And I have some confidence that that government will abide by decisions of the Supreme Court and of the circuit courts and of the district courts or of the California Supreme Court or the Court of Appeal or Superior Court. Are there going to be people that sometimes won't? Of course, in which case I hope that the appropriate actions is taken and the people that violate receive appropriate consequences. But if we don't, if the public isn't educated in terms of how sentencing occurs and what are the factors and considerations, you're going to be seeing propositions. Please remember the death sentence in California was a proposition. Three strikes was a proposition. A lot of things in California were propositions because the public felt, rightly or wrongly, that they weren't being heard. And I think that's a real danger, and I think we need to act appropriately to educate so that that is less likely to occur.
I think it goes to the heart of what this discussion is really about. I mean, when we look at what the local district attorney is doing, I think it's capitalizing on the lack of information and knowledge that the public has about what happens in the courts and trying to ignite kind of outrage about things that aren't explained in their full context. I think it's okay to disagree with the judge's sentence or, believe me, I have a lot of disdain for judges for giving out very harsh sentences. And, I certainly wouldn't want to be silenced on that. But I think the full context is really important. And we're seeing behaviors at the Hall of Justice in San Francisco that we've never seen before by this district attorney's office. A judge was assigned to one of the criminal courtrooms, Michelle Tong. She's been a judge for about 5 years. And before that, she was a very successful public defender. And the district attorneys announced that they were going to challenge her across the board on every single case. They didn't want her to hear any cases. This has never happened before. Even before she's gotten a single case, they were challenging her. When they've been asked, why are you doing that? You know, they basically, you know, privately were talking about her career as a public defender. Let me assure you that we have had to appear, the public defenders have appeared in front of so many former prosecutors that if we did the same thing, the whole system would collapse. Recently, though, the district attorney has shifted, and now they're saying that the reason they don't want to appear in front of her is that she was found to have mishandled a case as a public defender, where she was chastised by the Court of Appeal because she did not convey an offer or allow a client to accept a guilty, an offer for, in exchange for a guilty plea. Well, that's only part of the story. What the DAs don't tell you is that she was made an offer in a burglary case and was awaiting discovery in the case. She had wanted the fingerprints and DNA evidence, and the DA assured her that they were going to get it to her. Before she got the discovery, a new DA was assigned to the case and withdrew the offer. That's what she was condemned for. Ironically, when the district attorney's office filed a complaint at the state bar level, she was not found to have done anything wrong. And in fact, a district attorney, number two in the office, submitted a declaration on her behalf that said this was inappropriate, that this is not how we do things at the Hall of Justice. The offer was made and should have been kept open until she had the full discovery to properly advise her client, who, by the way, was indicating that he was innocent. So, you know, it's that sort of thing. We've never seen this kind of deceptive level of criticism leveled at a judge. And to use this case that was unpublished even, you know, is hiding their real motivations. They are very interested in trying to intimidate judges not to exercise the rehabilitative tool that the legislature has given to them. And hopefully the judges don't collapse to that pressure.
Isn't it really up to the district attorney and those assistant district attorneys who do the work day to day for her? Isn't it up to them to come in case after case and present the side about why this person should be doing it? And is it a failure of performance on that side that leads to some of these results?
I think so. And, you know, the part of the story that you don't hear about is just totally ironic. The DA will go in and challenge Judge Tong because they don't want her to hear a case. Then they go to another judge, and that judge reduces the felony to a misdemeanor because it shouldn't be in felony court. And they walk out of the courtroom and say, gee, okay, I guess that's the way it is. But had Judge Tong done it, they would be yelling and screaming at the outrage that she reduced a case to a misdemeanor. I mean, you know, the outcomes in these cases are going to be what they're supposed to be at the end of the day, you know?
I guess the real question that we haven't gotten to, and I'd like to do that before we run out of time, there are appropriate, probably more targeted responses when either side receives a result they don't like. Judge Hyman, maybe you'd like to jump in. What are some of the things that could have been done if they don't like the result of a sentence?
I mean, the district attorney could issue a press release, have a press conference, whatever, saying this case occurred, these facts occurred, and we, the people, are unhappy, want to bring it to the attention of the public, that we think a disservice occurred. Then it's up to someone like the California Judges Association or private lawyers who can speak on behalf of the court and give more information than was disclosed by the complaint. Again, I think a lot of these problems are occurring because of a lack of transparency. And, you know, judges have the opportunity to give reasons for their sentences, whether it's in criminal court, family court, or anywhere else where decisions are made. And I've always favored transparency. By giving transparency, you're giving the appellate court the advantage of your thinking, and sometimes you're going to get reversed because sometimes your decision-making is flawed. I'm not opposed to criticism. I've been criticized at different times in my professional life. Sometimes I thought the criticism was unfair, and sometimes upon reflection, I thought it was particularly helpful. And as a result of the particular criticism, sometimes I changed my practices in terms of how I did things. Usually, at a minimum, as a result of the criticism, I gave more information in decision-making. And I think that's a good thing. I think we all benefit when everything has the light of day. And everything does not necessarily have the light of day, whether it's criminal, family, or some other division of the court. I think the public is entitled, the parties are entitled, to know what judicial thinking is at the time that a decision is made. And I think that's helpful. And I think that when these kinds of criticisms come about, I think it would be helpful if the private bar would get involved, and also the California Judges Association would issue information to assist the public in understanding how judges make decisions. And thus far, they haven't done that, and I think that's a shortcoming.
I think that, you know, at the Hall of Justice, certainly in dealing with criminal matters, when we have experienced judges in the courtrooms, we're able to accomplish more. And I mean, that includes former prosecutors and former public defenders or defense attorneys. The benefit of trying a case in front of somebody that knows the work is that they give you a ruling, you can count on it, they understand the issues, you're not, you're speaking the same language. I've tried many heavy cases with former prosecutors and had perfectly good trials with them. The hard part for us is when this kind of what I'm going to call petty challenges, because somebody's a prosecutor or somebody's a former defense lawyer, I think it hurts us, because then instead of having an experienced judge in that courtroom, we get a judge whose expertise is in some kind of civil law. And they may be perfectly intelligent, they may be well-intentioned, but believe me, it's very challenging to get rulings that you can count on. I've been in trial with judges who change their rulings from day to day. You never know where you stand. You're walking in the courtroom and they've decided that, you know, your defense is, you know, it just, I could go on and on with details. I'm not going to do that here. We don't have the time. But I think that's the disservice here, that to have a balanced criminal justice system, you have to have people that are coming from different backgrounds, whether they're former police officers, whether they're former defense attorneys, whether they're former social workers, whatever they might be. And, you know, that's the way the system should work. It should reflect what our society looks like.
Recent statements from elected officials often seem to suggest they have no recourse when judges don't rule the way they would prefer. Is this correct? They have no way to ask somebody else to look at it, reconsider it?
Well, they can file appeals, but in order to file an appeal, there has to be a legal basis for the appeal. And sometimes if decisions aren't stated on the record, then you're not going to get anywhere with respect to an appeal.
Well, I mean, is your question that if there's a sentence that's within the legal legal allowance that somebody disagrees with, they have no recourse? Is that what you're?
Well, I guess that's really the issue. I mean, if the decision was within legal boundaries,
then there
may not be, but you could always circle back to that judge and say, you should have looked at this. Is there a reason? But for the most part, if it's within legal boundaries.
I think if you've got well-defined mitigation and aggravating circumstances and the court has done its due diligence and, You know, you've got a probation report making a recommendation. You've heard from the parties. You've heard from any of the affected victims or folks that want to be heard in sentencing. At some point, there's got to be finality. I mean, if you issue a sentence, that's the decision. I mean, it's not appealable just because you don't agree with the sentence. It's appealable, as Judge Hyman was saying, as if there's some legal error that you're going to allege.
Let me turn it over to, we have a caller on the line. Let me turn it to Martin from San Martin. Martin, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. First-time caller, long-time listener. I just have a quick comment about the judiciary in general. I can take your answer off the air, question, comment. But it seems to me that a lot of the decisions coming down from the bench are based in activism, and it just on the surface, I'm not an attorney or a judge, so, but on the surface, it appears that a lot of these things are coming down with the genesis of the argument coming from, I'm seeking this conclusion and I'm backing into it rather than looking at the case law and drawing my own conclusion. Like, it's the conclusions already been considered, and then we have to work our way into it. Do you find that to be occurring ever?
Well, I'm sure it occurs. How frequently does it occur? I think it occurs at the trial court level extremely infrequently. When we're talking about the appellate level or the U.S. Supreme Court level, so what you're talking about effectively is reverse engineering. Does it occur? Absolutely. Does it occur a lot at the trial court level? Not in my opinion.
Well, I appreciate you taking the call and voicing your opinion on the matter. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
What people don't generally know, it's not in common usage, is in addition to the individual laws that say you have a certain type of an offense, the offenses are very different, as are the people who have committed them, as are the people that have been hurt by them or maybe not hurt by them, and the reach of that particular action. And the higher courts have sent down guidelines called the rules of court, which will give you factors to look at that make a given instance worse or better than another one. And that sometimes guides judges a lot. And it's up to the attorneys to flush those factors out and help the judges reach the right decision in a given case.
Yeah, just in response to the caller, I mean, I know that it might seem inappropriate for a judge to sort of want to get to a certain conclusion and then back their way into how do they get there. But I think we do this often in our own lives. And I don't know that I can see that it could be abused, but I also see how it's natural reasoning. I mean, if you have somebody in front of you that's going to get sentenced and you're thinking to yourself, you know, I really like this individual. I think they've got a chance to turn it around. I'd like to do something for them other than send them to prison. You know, can I fashion something within the constraints of the law to get there? Like, that doesn't offend me, because that's speaking to the judge's experience and their entire oversight of the case to try to sort out how to fashion something that works within the law.
Well, no, you're basically what you're saying is the rules of court, because the rules of court address exactly what you're talking about in terms of which apply to felonies, but there's nothing saying you can't think about it in the same terms with respect to misdemeanors. But no, you're exactly right.
I think it's worth saying, and we often forget about this, but that we're often reading or hearing in the media about the some of the cases that we might categorize as failures, where somebody got a chance, a second chance, and they squandered it. But what we don't hear about are all the success stories. You know, judges are not making these decisions where they lean towards leniency just because they feel like it. They're they've experienced many success stories in seeing that giving somebody a chance or trying to fashion something that to an outsider might look extraordinary, but to them, with their experience, they've fashioned previously and seen success. And that's something to keep in mind. You know, you're dealing with judges that they're not handling one case a day. I mean, they're dealing with, hundreds of cases. And I try to remember that. When I get upset about one ruling, I try to remember that judge got it right hundreds of times today, and I'm fixated on the one ball that got thrown, you know?
We're just about out of time, and I did offer each of you to have a minute or so for any closing remarks or any final thoughts you wanted to share.
Well, I'll just say, I think, it's important that we be able to criticize judges. And I think there are instances where I could see where even having the peremptory challenge of a judge, where a particular party may not want to try a case in front of a judge for some reason. But I don't subscribe to the idea of a challenge against someone across the board in every single case. I think it's important that we let our attorneys exercise their discretion and make the individual decision. And when there's an office decision to do that, you have to be able to support it with more than a half of a story. You have to be able to prop it up with something that shows real bias.
And we're going to be looking at that in more detail in a couple weeks. And you're welcome to join us for that show as well. Tonight we were talking more about the comments after court, things that may threaten independence or threaten the lives of the jurists. But in a couple weeks we're going to be coming back here, and I'll talk to you about that when we're off air, see if you'd like to join us for that as well.
Sure.
Well, I think there needs to be more disclosure in terms of the light. People need to understand how the system works. And I think there needs to be more rehabilitation. I think every prison needs to have substance abuse that works. The good news is we know how to help people get clean and sober. We know how to treat literacy. We can teach someone literacy who's 80 years old, and it's very inexpensive. So how come we don't have literacy programs in every prison? How come we don't have substance abuse programs in every prison? And we need to get, since substance abuse is pushing most crime, not all, but most, why aren't we having more substance abuse at the local level and figuring out a way to get more people engaged in substance abuse at the local level? But there also needs to be reasonable consequences. Unfortunately, there will be people that need to go to prison. Unfortunately, there will be people that need to go to the county jail. That's unfortunate. But it needs to be appropriate, and it needs to be stated in terms of why a person is receiving a consequence. And everyone's entitled to be treated as an individual, whether they be a victim or whether they be a criminal defendant.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've discussed comments on judges and rulings and whether they've threatened the independence of the judiciary. Our guests tonight have been Matt Gonzalez, Chief Attorney of the San Francisco Public Defender's Office, and retired Judge of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, Eugene M. Hyman. I hope each of you will join us back again. Please join us again, Your Legal Rights, next week, where beginning at 6, we will discuss landlord-tenant law. Best of all, as always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. Thanks again to our guests and all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, The Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.